Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Here on the Liberty Radio Network. It's run-of-the-mill anti-government extremism, really. I don't know. It's focused on foreign policy. Mostly. So, yeah, today's going to be a show. I have a couple of guests lined up for you today. Allison Degger is going to be here from the Mondo Weiss blog. She's reporting from the West Bank, I think, or from East Jerusalem. Something like that. Anyway, I wouldn't say all hell, but say, I don't know, some hell is breaking loose there. In the West Bank, if not in Gaza, I don't know. Gaza's perpetual hell anyway, but we're going to find out what the hell's going on. People getting stabbed and people getting shot. An occupying army and a helpless captive population with rocks. Armed to the teeth with rocks and screwdrivers. Attacking civilians, not just the IDF, though, so. Anyway. So Allison Degger's going to be on the show. And then Jason Stapleton is going to be here. And you may be familiar. He's apparently a libertarian radio show host. And on Twitter, somebody sent me a link to his show where he's saying, man, let's give up on the terror war. This is stupid and call it off kind of thing. And said, hey, man, one of you ought to interview the other on their show. That'd be good. So we talked a bit and it seemed like a good idea. So I'm going to have him on basically to state his anti-war case, but then also to tell some stories, too, because apparently he was a mercenary in the Iraq and Afghan wars working for Blackwater and other companies, he said. So I don't want to tell you too much about it or that'll spoil all the fun, but, you know, should be an interesting interview. I realize on this show, I do it anyway, but I do realize it, that I'm too hard on everybody who don't get it yet, because the truth is, people are really just one good argument away from getting it. A lot of times they're just one good argument from me away from getting it. But a lot of times I get too angry and so I'm kind of too insulting. Give people reason not to listen, but I shouldn't do that, because the truth is you could take a Blackwater mercenary and show him some libertarianism, and then blam, he stops being a mercenary and becomes a libertarian. How do you like that, you know? Oh, see, I ruined it. Damn. I wasn't going to say that. Bad example. You could take a right-wing conservative Republican who follows the neocon party line on everything, and then he hears the libertarian talk some sense, and then blam. So, actually, I was talking with an old friend last night, and I was kind of criticizing the Black Lives Matter movement and saying that, man, they really need to change it to accountability for killer cops movement. Because if we're going to protect people from killer cops by abolishing racism first, and then the killer cop problem will go away, then this is going to take forever. Why are we going to go the long way around here? Let's focus on some accountability. And look at what a great opportunity they missed, unless I just missed it, which I do, you know, plead mostly ignorance on the subject. But as far as I can tell, the Black Lives Matter movement didn't take the opportunity to rally around the middle-aged white bikers who were massacred by the cops in Waco. Would have been a perfect time for them to say, see, even, you know, working class, upper working class and middle class white guys can get massacred by the cops with total impunity too. So come on down. And hey, you guys ought to stick up for us too. What do you think about that, maybe? But so my buddy said, I'm getting to the point. My buddy said, geez, I don't know, Scott Horton, are you sure you follow your own advice there? About really being ecumenical with everybody as good as you could? And are you saying that they should, you know, water down what they're about in order to appease a broader audience or whatever? So the answer to the first part is I fail myself at this all the time. That much is true. But the second part is, no, I wouldn't suggest that, you know, any movement should water down what they're about in order to appeal to a broader audience. I'm thinking more along the lines of they ought to have the vision to see that their movement isn't as narrow as they think it is, that they could, you know, follow their own logic to their own conclusions and form powerful alliances. You know, those bikers who were massacred in Waco by the cops there, 9 of them killed. They were there to discuss legislation, their biker legislative agenda. Right? Here's, you know, 10,000, I don't know, 50,000 voters in a block in the great state of Texas right now. What a powerful, what a great group to form an alliance with, especially right when they have just been the victims of the worst kind of police brutality. Snipers just blowing their heads off. You know, it's like the Branch Davidians held the sign out the window back in 1993. Rodney King, we understand. We got the same problem here. Jackbooted government thugs. Lawless ones. Completely out of control. Murdering American civilians. Texans! But my buddy said, yeah, I don't know, I'm not so sure you do such a good job of appealing to the right and the left with all your, you know, radicalism and whatever. So, I guess, really, he's kind of got a point, right? I could water down the message a little bit to get across to more people better. Or maybe I could try to focus on ways that my radical message ought to appeal to everyone. You know? Like, you shouldn't have to be a libertarian to think that if a cop murders somebody that they ought to be held accountable for that, just like anybody else. You have to be a libertarian to think that? You have to be a libertarian to think that the burden of proof is on those who want to keep America permanently at war instead of those who know better? Shouldn't be. And you shouldn't have to be a libertarian to understand that the Misesian Austrian school economists correctly described the causes and the consequences of an inflationary monetary policy. The distortions, the artificial booms, and the very real busts that we suffer. It's strictly a descriptive kind of a thing. You don't have to even be against that. You could be for that. Good old booms and busts. Gotta love central banking. But you gotta admit they're right on the facts. So, I don't know. Everybody should find a way to keep their message as radical and pure as they possibly can and broaden its appeal at the same damn time. How about that? Shouldn't have to sell out to appeal broader. You know what I look at it as? It's the difference between Ron Paul and Rand Paul. Ron Paul is a radical, and he's got something for everybody. If you're sick and tired of cops murdering people, you're sick and tired of drug wars and mass incarceration, sick and tired of wars, sick and tired of taxes, sick and tired of regulations, sick and tired of gun control, sick and tired of government busybodiness, Ron Paul's got something for you. Left, right, or don't even know what those things mean or anything else, Ron Paul believes in the same thing as you very strongly on at least a couple of things, and you ought to try to follow his chain of logic. You might find that he's very convincing on some other stuff, too. Rand Paul panders to all sides with little half-assed trial balloons about what he might agree with them on, maybe if they'll give him a little bit of love, which they don't, because they're not interested in buying what he's selling. And that's the difference. I wouldn't urge anybody to sell out and pander and be like Rand. I'm saying be radical, but show others why they have the same interests as you, you know? Make common cause and make actual change. Maybe. At least make good arguments. Hey, all, Scott here. The thing is, I need you guys to help me to get these download numbers up. So do me a favor and sign up for the podcast feeds of this show. You can choose the whole show or just the interviews at iTunes and Stitcher. All the buttons you need are at the top of the right margin at scotthorton.org. The more subscribers I have, the more iTunes and Stitcher will help promote the show to new listeners. If you're a hardcore fan, brand new or from way back, please leave them customer ratings and reviews, too. Trying to get these wars ended. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Listen, somebody asked me about on Twitter, hey, can you address this on your show? Why is Bernie Sanders agreeing with the Republicans on the Export-Import Bank, the EXIM Bank? I almost answered him right there on Twitter, but then I thought, well, he asked me to answer him on the show, so I'll answer him on the show. This is a I have to assume, I don't know that much about Bernie Sanders, honestly. I have to assume this is a very consistent position of his against corporate welfare. I mean, I don't know if he's against all corporate welfare, but for a socialist senator from Vermont, it's a very easy position to take that, hey, welfare for poor people, not for billionaires. If Boeing needs capital in order to, be involved in international trade, then let them go to the bank and apply for a loan like everybody else. Why should Boeing be on welfare? Now, the real question is, why are the Republicans good on this? And I think the answer is it's one of those where for enough of them, their free market rhetoric, you know, this was basically came up politically as a litmus test of whether they really believed in the free market or whether they just say that, but really they're a bunch of cronies. And I don't know if it's that Boeing has really leaned Democrat lately or if there's other, you know, ulterior motives behind it. But it seems like basically it's Tea Party politics on the right saying that, hey, this is not fiscally responsible to do. And I don't know, man. I guess I'm kind of scratching my head. There must be another secret reason that we don't know about, right? Some politics about who's getting bankrolled specifically at whose expense or something. Some crony got on the bad end of an EXIM deal or something. I don't know. It couldn't possibly be principle at play. And then, importantly, I don't know whether they've killed it or not. I guess there was a try to kill it. But I know Elizabeth Warren got all wishy-washy on it, speaking of corrupt interests. And that ought to be an absolute, a knock it out of the park kind of thing. Slow ball for her. But nope, she buckled on it. Because, you know, donations. That's how the whole empire works, and I mean foreign and domestic. Tax us all and inflate. They give that money out to the corrupt and connected, who then recycle the smallest amounts, the smallest percentages of that money back into the system to continue the bribery, to continue cashing in at the rest of everybody's expense. And this is a great one, by the way, to apply what the guys at the 10th Amendment Center call the Horton Rule, where you attack the right from the right. Any Republican who's for the EXIM Bank is a communist. Hey, how come you're a communist when it comes to really rich people cashing government checks? What do you think this is? Trotskyism or some crap? I don't know. Red bait them. Call them a collectivist. And then surely you can attack the left from the left on this too. Anyone who's a Democrat who supports the EXIM Bank has a hell of a lot of explaining to do. When don't you know there are people out of work? Don't you know that there are children who are just dying to get a government school education? For whatever reason. I guess their parents went to government school and so they think that's a good idea. Anyway. EXIM Bank. How in the world could anyone who is not a direct beneficiary of the Ex-Im Bank support it? What argument could they possibly make? Well, I personally am just for corruption. I want the system to destroy itself as fast as possible. Something like that, maybe? I don't know. I'm trying to come up with good excuses. All right. Now, here's something I don't do enough on the show, but I need to do this real quick here before we start getting to our interviews. And that is tell you about my sponsors. You hear ads on the show, but, you know, they're just ads and you kind of tune out and you don't pay attention. But I'm here to tell you that I need you to patronize my sponsors. Like, for example, if you like reading about the war state, read the book The War State, or get it on audiobook from Listen and Think Audio. It's by Mike Swanson. He helps sponsor this show. And he also runs WallStreetWindow.com. If you do invest in the markets, if you have any money, you're trying to protect your savings or even make a little money in the making smart bets and whatever, follow WallStreetWindow.com. It's well worth it. Great advice. Follow him on paper. See if he's as smart as I say he is. And then, go ahead. Take his advice. And if you want to read about the early history of the rise of the new right military-industrial complex after World War II, then you read The War State, all about the Eisenhower, Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy years there. And then also I want to tell you about MasterSamuraiTech.com. Maybe you hate having a job and you want to own your own business. This seems to me like the perfect one. And if I was, you know, very good at technical things, and hell, I don't know. I ain't really talented, but I ain't stupid. I guess I could do it, you know? I don't know. It seems like a great kind of career to me. You know, you own your own business, repairing big-ticket appliances. You know, the big, expensive, not even necessarily expensive, just the new washers and dryers and refrigerators and, I guess, stoves and whatever. The new high-tech EPA mandate fulfilling appliances need skilled techs, and the old refrigerator repairman isn't trained up to do it. There's a huge hole in the market, a huge demand for techs that know how to work on these kinds of appliances. And you can own your own business, and at MasterSamuraiTech.com, not only do they teach you the ropes on how to do everything, they teach you how to create your own business doing it too. And how to run it. The model. Scott Brown at Master Samurai Tech. Man, I almost want to just quit and do that. I'm tired of talking about war every day for a decade straight. Longer than that. But anyway, I'm not going to quit. But you should go and check that out, man, if you're sick of having a job or you're sick of trying to find a job and not being able to find one. Maybe just make your own. Maybe build up a business and train some guys of your own and then sit on your ass all day while they do the work. That's the American dream. MPV Engineering. As I say in the spot, this isn't for everyone, but if you do have an industrial project, and I've heard by email that at least one deal's been made. One listener of this show has hired MPV Engineering to work on a project, which is music to my ears, and I know this doesn't apply to everybody, but, you know, if you're doing industrial technology, manufacturing, or any of these kinds of things, you check out mpvengineering.com, and Christopher Smith will help you get your work done for real. Check them out there. And then, of course, there's the Council for the National Interest, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. You want to buy and sell some precious metals, Liberty.me, where I do a couple of shows. Liberty stickers and the bumper sticker, the Future Freedom Foundation, Darren's Coffee, QR code commodity discs. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is Allison Degger. She is assistant editor of MondoWeiss.net. Welcome to the show, Allison. How are you doing?
Good. A bit busy.
Yeah, must be. And I'm sorry, I meant to ask you off the air. Did I pronounce your last name right there?
You did, yes.
Okay, good deal. So, let's start with the latest here. Clashes break out across the West Bank after Netanyahu declares, quote, all-out war. I guess just catch us up on the latest news, the last week worth of skirmishes and casualties, if you could, and then maybe we'll get to a little bit bigger context.
Sure. So the last week, the Tinderbox has sort of ignited. We have seen unprecedented levels of clashes over the past decade, and a lot of commentators are using language questioning if something like a third intifada, the Arabic term for an uprising, has started, although very cautiously, because there isn't any kind of formal leadership. The Palestinian leaders haven't moved in that direction. And we are seeing, you know, despite heavy, heavy numbers of injuries and arrest, a real crackdown in Jerusalem, but there is a bit of restraint in the West Bank. So over the last week, things really kicked off after a settler couple was attacked by a Palestinian in a drive-by shooting. And for the Palestinians, it was seen as a revenge attack for a brutal a killing, a burning alive of a Palestinian family about a month before. And so the narrative that people are experiencing is sort of vigilante citizen attacks against one another, but that at the same time, the Israeli army, and you referenced Netanyahu's statement made last Monday to the Security Council, is exercising broad, sweeping strokes, almost tantamount to an incursion, but without formally stating so. And they're cracking down on demonstrations. In the past week alone, there have been 1,553 Palestinians wounded from Israeli security forces in demonstrations across the West Bank and Jerusalem, around 100 from live fire. And daily we are seeing Palestinians moving to take violent, generally stabbing attacks against Israeli civilians. And what we're noticing is that these are not from organized militant groups or armed factions of political parties. These are young people around age 18, 19, 20 who make statements to their families and on Facebook in the week, you know, very short time, like 2 weeks before, that they're motivated by the cycle of violence that's already in place. So the Palestinians see this as this escalation as faulted by Israel's militarized response that's been so heavy-handed that's inciting people. And the Israelis are saying that, you know, their actions are deterrent and are not incitement. But, of course, as they are ramping up steps, it has yielded increased violence.
Yeah, well, On the Palestinian side there, obviously they have the right to resist occupation. There's no question there, but it's just so stupid for how wrong it is to attack innocent civilians on the side of the road. I read one of these where I think the guy stabbed an IDF soldier first, and then he just turned on whoever happened to be around, stabbed a 60-year-old lady, something like this. I mean, first of all, individuals are individuals, and she's got the right to not be stabbed kind of thing. But second of all, you know, it completely undermines the actual truth of the situation about who's David and who's Goliath in this thing, when Palestinians are attacking innocent civilians instead of the IDF. It completely takes all the focus off of the IDF attacking civilians in the West Bank, where they are the occupying power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Israeli line so far has been discussing this as an uptick of violence and that there's no systemic issues at play. and except for, you know, a Palestinian terror on their citizens, you know, but at the same time, we still have Israeli citizens, you know, engaging in vigilante attacks against Palestinians, and they're treated much differently in these instances. And this is something that's really angering Palestinians. So, for example, today there was three attacks, unfortunately, by Palestinians on Israelis, and one of the Palestinian attackers was shot on scene. In another instance that was partly caught on video earlier this week, Fadi Iran was seen running in front of Damascus Gate, which is in East Jerusalem, after stabbing an Israeli, and throngs of settlers were chanting, "Shoot him, shoot him," and Israeli police sent him down. And the thinking was, for Palestinians, this is an assassination. When our citizens engage in crimes, they are killed before a trial. And when Israeli civilians do the same thing, they get the benefit of a court system and legal protections. And so you really see the lack of rights playing out in the field when these gruesome acts are committed, where Palestinians are just not afforded the same assurance to life as Israeli citizens.
Well, and yeah, when it comes to soldiers and settlers, they hardly ever even face a courtroom, much less summary execution.
Yeah, settlers... acts of violence have, I think it's around a 1.9% conviction rate. And according to the Israeli human rights group Yeshdin, you know, the issue is just failure at every step of the way. It's not as though they're entering a courtroom and the judge is just scoffing them off, but that while there is a very intense monitoring system intact in the West Bank to look at the behaviors of Palestinians, there really is none in place in the West Bank. I mean, for settlers. So when an act happens, you know, basic policing just isn't there. Sometimes investigators don't even go to the crime scene. They don't interview witnesses and victims. And so, you know, it's an abysmal rate. And it's been constant for a decade. So it's like 1.9% conviction rate for settler attacks on Palestinians for the past 10 years. So we really have seen no change. There's been attempts in Knesset to bolster up those efforts. There was one police unit added. It's terribly underfunded. And right now, as you know, Knesset has a strong lobby representing the settler wing inside of the government, and they really push to keep funding down to look into those crimes.
And I would really urge people to go to MondoWeiss.net and find this video of the 18-year-old here. It's as egregious as any police shooting we've been talking about here in the United States, where the guy is, you know, I don't know, at least 15, 20 feet away, 50 feet away from anyone. I don't know if his hands are up, but he certainly is not attacking anyone. I don't think he has anything in his hands. He's sort of just standing there, and the cops just waste him. Just, they didn't feel like, you know, trying to cuff him, so they just killed him instead, kind of thing. And, you know, it's as bad as Walter Scott being executed on the front page of the New York Times or any of the rest of these, except, oh, it's a Palestinian, so apparently their lives matter even less than American blacks, something like that. I'm not exactly sure how they rank on the totem pole there, but.
Yeah, for Palestinians, they're looking at, when they look at these cases, you know, while they do acknowledge, you know, he was committing a criminal act, the way that they're perceiving it is, if you commit a criminal act or not, you're still open for such an extrajudicial killing. You know, at the beginning of the month, 18-year-old Hadil HaShalmon from Hebron was crossing a checkpoint into the Israeli-controlled area of the city. The city is...
In fact, I'm sorry, Allison. I'm terrible at watching the clock here. Let's hold this and let you tell this very important story on the other side of this break here. It's Allison Degger, sure, everyone, from MondoWeiss.net. Very important website, MondoWeiss.net. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Allison Degger from MondoWeiss.net, the great Phil Weiss and friends over there, MondoWeiss.net. She's assistant editor there. And you're writing from the West Bank, is that right?
The position's based in Jerusalem, but I report from all over, and mostly my beat is the West Bank.
Yeah, okay, right on. All right, and so I'm sorry, yeah, we were interrupted by the break and my bad timing here, but you were going to tell the story of the 18-year-old young woman who was executed at the checkpoint earlier. Was it late last month, or when was it again?
September 22nd, Hadil Hashamon, 18 years old, got up early, went across the checkpoint that divides the city of Hebron between Israeli and Palestinian control. This is an agreement from the Hebron protocols, part of this era of making security arrangements and negotiated deals between the Israelis and Palestinians to move towards a Palestinian state. And while the state did not happen, these arrangements did stay intact. And so she crossed into this area where it is, you know, home to around, I think, 500 settlers or so, but the whole, and thousands of Palestinians, but the whole area is like a ghost town. Palestinians are not allowed to enter their homes from the main street by law. They have to walk around through back alleyways and enter from the side. It's a very tense environment. And so she went into this this zone because she often visited low-income families, and she was going that morning to do just that. And when she was in the crossing, soldiers began yelling at her in Hebrew, a language she did not understand. Another Palestinian who spoke Hebrew attempted to intervene. She stepped back. There was a metal barricade between her and the soldiers, and she was fired upon around seven times. And then left to bleed out on the ground before any medical intervention. Ultimately, she was transferred to an Israeli hospital, but she had died before she reached the facility. And her family is saying that the Israeli army planted a weapon on the scene. The Israeli army claims that she had a knife and was using that to threaten soldiers, and so they acted under threat to life. However, there's a series of 27 photographs, I believe, that was taken by a Brazilian activist who since left the country, who stood there for 25 minutes before the incident and during the incident, and he was about 8 meters from her. He saw no knife in the area around her. There's no knife in any of the photographs. And so in this killing, Palestinians feel like they're seeing kind of the ultimate cruelty of the occupation. An innocent young woman off to, have a kind heart, on a kind-hearted venture, and just gunned down and left to be killed. And after she was died and while she was being loaded up into the ambulance, the Israeli army allowed for settlers to come remove an abaya, a loose black covering over her clothing, a modesty covering to expose her clothes underneath and photograph her dead body. So
out there in public as she laid on the street? They did
While they were loading her into the ambulance, they took selfies with her body.
They took selfies with her. Wow. Now, and I want to go back to the part about they let her bleed out. It took her about 45 minutes, or it took them about 45 minutes to even get her in the ambulance, right? And I read that one of the Israeli settlers that was standing there was an EMT, and they're all just standing there gawking at her. And wow, then they even Abu Ghraib style took pictures of themselves posing with her corpse. What fun.
Father told me that was like another death that she experienced. Her father, incidentally, is the director of a hospital in Hebron, and so he's very, very aware of the status of her medical condition from the time that she was first shot until the time that she arrived at the Israeli hospital. And he told me he spoke on the phone with the Israeli surgeon that attempted to treat her. That surgeon called him to offer condolences, and the family was, of course, you know, heartbroken that there was no chance for her to survive, holding her and denying her medical treatment for such time.
Absolute barbarism. And, you know, as James North said on the show back then a couple of weeks ago, well, what was she even doing at a checkpoint? What checkpoint? Oh, she has no rights at all, no human rights at all. She lives at the pleasure of the Israeli military that occupies her homeland, period. That's it. Imagine Texans or other Americans listening to this show. If you really had checkpoints all the time between this neighborhood and that neighborhood, just to travel around your own damn county where you were born, of a foreign army, that it's up to them to allow you to go here or there, and they might kill you if they feel like it, or your sister.
I mean, that area is generally described as, let's say, the most tense city, the most tense section of the most tense city in the most tense district or area of this part of the world, you know, of this region. So it's a very, you know, it has an visitors will note it does have an ominous feel when you walk in there. You know, you can almost like reach your hand out into the air and just grab a hold of it because it's thick. You know, it's quite an atmosphere. But to bring it up to speed with what it has to do with today is that Palestinians are looking at her death and the death of somebody like Fadi Amoun, who did attack Israelis, as very similar, that their rights weren't, that they didn't have rights. And so we can say that this is sort of the undermining motivating factor that's going on. People are fed up of after 10 years without any kind of progress to the political program that's in place, that they don't have a path to either statehood or some other formulation that guarantees them more protections. And ultimately, that's what it's about for the Palestinians. This is a peaking of frustrations that they don't have rights.
Yeah. Well, now, and can you explain this about the new, is it a new law or a new regulation that approves sniper fire against stone throwers? And by stone throwers, they mostly mean minors.
Right.
This is the new law that they'll just kill you for throwing a rock at a soldier or a tank?
So right now, what you're speaking of is a new policy in Jerusalem where 22 caliber shots can be fired at those that are throwing stones and that those that do not pose direct threat to life to police or soldiers. It's a pretty relaxed policy. And then there's a couple other minor but really heavy-handed measures that were passed along with it. So if you're...
So they specifically say, you're saying, if they specifically say, even if it's not a threat, so we're not talking about they're dropping boulders on their heads and really risking lives. There's small boys throwing small rocks. That's good enough to shoot them with 22 rifles.
Yeah, I mean, the wording of the announcement from the government said... you know, paraphrasing, but it was explicit that in instances where there is not threat to life to the soldier or the police, they are legally allowed to use these weapons against stone throwers.
And I'm sorry I interrupted you there. I can't help it sometimes. Go ahead, please.
Oh, no problem. And so some of the other regulations included if one was over 18, they could get a minimum sentence of 4 years. The prime minister announced that he was seeking legislation to make a maximum sentence of 20 years. So 20 years for 19-year-old stone throwing. And then for youth, for minors under 18, increased fines for their parents would be administered. But it's important to remember that more or less this policy is already in place in the West Bank, right? Because in the West Bank, Palestinians are ruled under military code, right? So in Jerusalem, Palestinians have a Jerusalem ID. There's 350,000 of them. They're not citizens of any state. If they want to travel internationally, they generally get a laissez-passer, or there's an agreement with Jordan where they can get a passport. But they're not Israeli citizens. But since the 1980s, when Israel annexed Jerusalem unilaterally, they see Israel, they see East Jerusalem and all of Jerusalem as under Israeli jurisdiction. So that means that the laws that are applied there are the laws that you would apply for citizens. So a big takeaway that wasn't really discussed is that in a sweeping gesture, these 22 caliber bullets that are now allowed to be used, Netanyahu is basically saying, I'm going to pass a law that allows people who, you know, pay taxes to a city, who vote in a city, who we say, you know, we govern under the laws as if they are citizens, we're going to treat them just like people that are under military occupation. I mean, it's a real downgrading of the rights of East Jerusalem Palestinians. It's a militarization of the eastern part of the city.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, we're already a little bit over time, but could you say one thing real quick about what exactly is going on with the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and do you think that the Israelis are really making a move to consolidate control over it and exclude Muslims from it or something like that? Seems like that's what the Palestinians fear.
Well, the Palestinian Authority is suggesting that what the ultimate goal is to make some kind of sharing agreement like the Ibrahimi Mosque or Israelis would call the Tomb of the Patriarchs, and so to split use of the facility. So maybe that means on certain days one religious group uses it, on certain days another religious group uses it, or you just take a line, draw a line down the middle, and you divide up use of it. And any changes to that area is very, very, very sensitive. I mean, not just the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We're talking regional issues and Jordan is who administers over the Muslim religious sites from an old agreement. They're discussing recalling their ambassador over this. I mean, it takes it out of Israel Palestine to something larger. Now, for the Palestinians, they would point to the fact that there's around 12,000 Israeli settlers who visit the Haram al-Sharif, a compound that houses the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock every year. And they say 10 years ago, you know, the number was like in the hundreds. And so from their perspective, the status quo has already been changed so that there is a sharing of that space. So they feel it's already happened and that it will keep happening and that it will keep being limited. The mosque, and even today, Jamal Zalka, who is a member of Knesset with the Joint Arab List, the third largest party in Israel, a member of Knesset, he was denied access to Al-Aqsa Mosque. Closed for members of Knesset who, you know, out in these parts, there's generally an allowance for members of Knesset to have access to these kinds of places, even if they're closed to the general public. So they're saying it's already changed and it will change more. Israel is saying, quite interestingly, announcing that we have changed the status quo is an incitement of violence, right? So they're not addressing charges of allowing more settlers onto the compound. Religious Jews are not allowed to pray as part of this old agreement. And it does happen, and it does happen with Israeli police protection. So that's a violation of the agreement. The last time I attended a press conference by the Israeli government when this was brought up, they said police stop it from happening, but every journalist out here has seen it happen, you know, time and again. So they're really not enforcing any of that. And this is also the focal point of all of these tensions that are happening right now. I mean, if you look at the clashes across the West Bank and Jerusalem, actually most of them are in Jerusalem, and that's where most of this is going down, and Al-Aqsa is at the center of all of it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Allison. Great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
All right, y'all. That is Allison Degger. She is assistant editor at Mondo Weiss, reporting from East Jerusalem there, mondoweiss.net. And this one is the latest, I believe. Clashes break out across West Bank after Netanyahu declares an all-out war. And we'll be right back in just a minute. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, our next guest today is Jason Stapleton. He is a nationally syndicated libertarian radio show host, host of the Jason Stapleton program. His website is jasonstapleton.com. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me, man.
Hey, very happy to have you here. So, it was a Twitter friend of the both of ours, I guess a listener to both of our shows, who said that, well, at least one of us ought to interview the other here. So it seemed like a pretty good idea to me. And you had sent me a link to, I guess, a clip from your radio show, but it's a video clip from your radio show where you're explaining why it sounds like when it comes to the war on terrorism, you're over it. And let's give do nothing a chance there. You want to try to start with that and make that case there?
Well, yeah, I just think it's a strategy we haven't tried yet. I have somewhat of a unique position and unique experience of it because I spent a lot of time in Iraq and Afghanistan. I worked for the State Department or as a contractor for the State Department for several years and also for various other government entities in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. I lived there off and on for about 5 years. Both on the street in places like Kurdistan and also in compounds and on forward operating bases in places like Mosul. So I've seen it firsthand, and I disagree entirely with the way it's being handled and the way it's being managed and why we went to war. And I'm not, I know what your show is about, and I agree with virtually everything that you guys, that you talk about on the show, but I'm not anti-war. It's not that I don't believe that there are times when we need to go to war, but I just simply believe that war should be a last resort that we use only to protect our individual liberty and our sovereignty. And that is, there is so rare an occasion when that is actually necessary, that we end up fighting what is most have considered perpetual war. And I just say it's done nothing but destabilize the region. It hasn't made us safer. It hasn't decreased the amount of death and violence in the Middle East. It's only increased. And so how about we try the exact opposite of what created that death and that violence? And that's pretty much the position that you heard me take.
Mm. All right. Well, so now, I mean, it seems like a pretty obvious rejoinder to that is, yeah, Obama. Well, all we need is, you know, competent neocons to go in there. And, you know, Obama shouldn't have pulled out of Iraq and all those kind of conservative talking point arguments. If only we'd stayed, if only we had backed the rebels more, if only, then everything would be fine right now. It's the leading from behind and refusal to dominate effectively that's led us into the current crisis.
Well, that shows an ignorance beyond the pale, and it's one that you constantly hear Republicans and neocons make, is that, well, we just don't have the right people in charge. It's kind of like the way Democrats talk about the reason government needs to be bigger and the reason we haven't been successful is we just don't have the right people in charge. And if we just have the right people making the right policies, then suddenly we'll become the saviors of the world and we'll clean up the whole mess. But that wasn't true. It wasn't true when George Bush took us into Iraq. It wasn't true when we fought the war in Afghanistan. Keep in mind, I've actually been in the region. I was there during the time in 2005, 2006 in Iraq And during the what was supposed to be the rebuilding phase, I've seen the way the State Department operates. Those things just simply aren't true. It's not that you don't have the right people driving the bus. It's that you got the bus headed in the wrong direction.
All right. So now here's another argument then. Whoever's fault it is, there are now more Al-Qaeda guys than ever. On September 11th, there were a couple of hundred. By October 11th, there were about a couple of dozen. And then now there are at least a couple of few 10,000 spread across North Africa, the Middle East. Call it Bush and Obama's fault. How about this? I'll call it Bush and Obama's fault. But so now what? I think a lot of people on the right are going to say, okay, maybe we can't rely on competency to do it, but maybe, you know, if we could just somebody hammer out the right strategy, something, how can we do nothing in the face of what Hosni Mubarak, our loyal sock puppet in Egypt, predicted 10,000 bin Ladens if you invade Iraq?
Well, I think that, first of all, there is a misconception about what Al-Qaeda is and what ISIS is and all these groups. There's some misconception that these are somehow large organizations that have been constructed out of nothing. These all interrelate. Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, ISIS, Hezbollah. Well, Hezbollah is really different, but these particular groups are connected together. That's what that's what Al-Qaeda really is. It's just a network of people who are communicating and sharing information. And the idea that, well, now we've got even more. So we've made bad decisions. It's taken us into places where we shouldn't have gone to stir up a hornet's nest. And what we've ended up doing is creating more bad guys than we had before. So now the answer is to continue the same process that brought us to where we are today in hopes that somehow, again, a change in strategy is going to allow us to be more successful. I don't think it's going to work, and I just don't think that Americans are set up. I don't think that the government really wants it to work. I think what the government really wants to do is they want to create an avenue through which they can funnel money from the taxpayer into a military-industrial complex that includes places like the State Department for humanitarian projects, and that they can create greater bureaucracy, greater infrastructure with which to utilize money that they're stealing or printing or borrowing for the purpose of growing government. And I mean, that's what I saw when I worked with the State Department. You have these massive number of bureaucrats who really didn't do anything except just create new projects. And then once it got big enough, you needed people to manage the projects that were being created. And then you need people to oversee them. And it just turns into a huge process of people trying to justify their existence and justify their jobs. And so I think that the war piece of it, the war component, is just one small piece of a much larger organizational structure just designed to transfer wealth and reduce liberty.
All right, now, just real quick at the end of this segment here, I'm interested. Are you as flabbergasted as me when you hear the people on TV crying that Russia promised to only bomb ISIS, and now they're bombing al-Nusra too, and that's not fair?
Well, I don't understand why anybody thought that. It seemed that this came as a shock to some people, that at some point Russia was going to step in and it was going to take over, and that it was sending planes and troops over there, that somehow it wasn't going to get involved in a ground campaign. I mean, when you think about it, let me put it to you like this. Vladimir Putin is very much a statist. He believes in a strong state. And so he is trying to create stability by reinforcing the state, which is run by Assad in Syria. And he probably thinks that in so doing, he can also solidify his country and himself as someone who could actually accomplish the mission of reducing or pushing back terrorism or this guerrilla war that's happening there. The issue with that, the problem with it is that you can't ever really get rid of that. That's one of the things people don't understand about guerrilla war, is that you can destroy the army, but the people simply kind of fade away into the population. And they stay there. And they'll stay there until you eventually leave. And so what he's trying to do in Syria is he's trying to backbone Assad so that he can create stability by maintaining the state. And so, no, it doesn't come as a shock to me that people don't understand that, because very few people really understand foreign policy. Very few people really understand what's happening in the Middle East.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me like they got this kind of half-truth that has a little something to it, but it's out of context, that ISIS is too brutal even for Al-Qaeda, they've said for a couple of years now. And now they've perfectly segued that into meaning that, you know, al-Nusra, which is just Al-Qaeda in Syria, still loyal to Zawahiri, the butcher in New York, they're the moderates compared to the Islamic State. And it really is just that easy. A couple of turns of phrase, and you'll have Americans outright allying with the only real enemies the American people have in the world. But now we got to take this break. But then when we come back, we're going to talk more with Jason Stapleton about the terror war. JasonStapleton.com. Check out his radio show and archives there. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with Jason Stapleton. He's also a libertarian radio show host. We're talking about the wars and things. All right, now, Jason says in your bio here, you're former Force Recon, and you mentioned you're a contractor there working for the State Department. Can you tell us a little bit more about your time inside the national security state?
Yeah, you want to know about the military or about my contracting work?
Well, which was worse?
Well, when I was in the military, I had a much different mentality about it. I really believed I joined the military because, whether you think it's naive or not, I joined the military because I genuinely wanted to defend liberty and defend freedom, and I bought into this idea that that's what I was doing when I joined the service. I think that there are different people. Dave Grossman wrote a book called On Killing, and in the book he talks and divides people up into three different categories: your wolves, sheep, and sheepdog, or sheepdogs. And I always considered myself a sheepdog. And I said there are people who need to stand up for those who can't defend themselves, and those of us who can and are willing to should do it. And that's why I joined. And I started out in a basic infantry unit. I said, if we need to go to war and my country needs me, I will go. And I swallowed that pill hook, line, and sinker. And I ended up joining a sniper team. I spent a year with snipers before I went over to 5th Force Reconnaissance Battalion in Okinawa, where I did counterterrorism, hostage rescue, explosive breaching, and the like. And then after I got out of the service, I joined Blackwater, which is a private military organization that I'm sure your listeners are familiar with. If not, you can Google them. There's plenty have been written about them. And I worked with them in the State Department, with the State Department and with other government and independent agencies to provide security to diplomats and ambassadors and politicians who needed to move in and around those countries. And so that's my experience with the military and with war. I was in, as I said, in Mosul in 2005, which is one of the most dangerous areas in Iraq still to this day. Spent a great deal of time in Kurdistan up in the north. Spent a lot of time in Kabul, Afghanistan, working for the U.S. ambassador there as part of his detail. And so I've seen it all, everything from provincial reconstruction, building roads and water and stuff like that, to how we dealt with the Afghan president and the providing for the safety and security of their country. And so I've had a chance to sit in on a lot of meetings, and just because I'm, you know, a fly on the wall. And so I that's why I how I come at these things. It's not that I come at them from a position of guessing or what I think. It's what I sat through, what I lived through, and really while I was in Afghanistan, I started asking a lot of questions about why am I here? What are we doing here? Because the line I've been fed for years that says I'm here to defend liberty against tyranny, it just really isn't true. This is just a bunch of people CYA-ing and trying to grab as much free money as they can from our government. And I started reading a little bit, and I read Ron Paul's book, The Revolution. And it was like, man, it was eye-opening to me. It was like, well, everything I believe, but I didn't know how to express, was in that book. And explained it so clearly and so articulately and so simply that it was just undeniable. And that was kind of how my track began, and I just continued down that trail to this day.
And that's really great to hear. And I'm absolutely in agreement with you that that's Ron's best book, and I've read all of them. But it really is something, and it is, you know, if people ask me, that's the one I would definitely have them read. And I know that there are, you know, who knows, uncounted stories that are just like yours where they read that, and you know, I think there probably must be a word for that in German or something, where you always thought something, but you never quite heard anybody say it in English all the way to the end before, or whatever. But then once you do, you go, ah, exactly, yeah, that.
Well, and, no, because you got the two different camps, right? And you think, well, I don't belong there, and I don't belong there, so I must be somewhere in the middle. I must be an independent. And what I realized in reading that book was, no, there's a name for what I believe. It's a libertarian. That's what I am. I'm a very extreme limited government kind of guy. I'm not an anarchist. I'm just a very, very limited government person. And, that's one of the things that I try and do on my show, is just kind of give people evidence for that. And I'm looking for people. I'm not trying to preach to the choir. I'm not trying to surround myself with yes men who agree with everything that I have to say. What I'm looking for are those people who feel disenfranchised, like they don't fit in a community and their beliefs aren't really being represented. And I just want to say to them, hey, have you tried this? And here are some examples of what libertarianism looks like in the real world. And to try and pull some of those people over, because I think if we can start getting more people to identify as libertarians rather than independents or Republicans or Democrats, that's how you really begin to spark a movement. And that ultimately is what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing, especially, you know, people who don't really have a specific political identity at all, or people who were liberals until they saw just how crummy the liberals are, or vice versa on the Republican side. Then, you know, it's our chance to try to get those who wash out of those other political movements and try to show them. I'm reminded of a guy that rode in my cab one time. He said, well, I agree with the left on some things and the right on some things. And I said, oh, you might be a libertarian. He said, yeah, I think we need a lot of regulation and a big welfare state, but I also think that we need to take the fight to them damn Arabs and bomb the whole Middle East too. So I say, yeah, no, you're not a libertarian.
No, you're not a libertarian.
You're what we call a moderate.
You're almost there. Yeah. No, but, you know, and one thing I try to do, Matt Kibbe wrote a decent book, called Don't Hurt People and Don't Take Their Stuff. And I found that is just one of the simplest ways to start a conversation about libertarianism. And they say, hey, what do you believe? What is this libertarian thing? Well, I say, we believe two basic things, that we don't hurt people and we don't take their stuff. Is that something that you believe in? And without fail, every single person says, yeah, I don't believe it's right to hurt people. And I don't believe it's right to steal. Well, that's a framework with which to start a conversation. And so I try and break things down to really not the lowest common denominator, but I don't try and start off with man, economy, and state. I don't try and hit them with Bastiat in our first conversation about liberty. I just talk to them about, hey, here are the principles that I believe in, and I think they're things that everybody can surround themselves with and support.
Yeah.
And although we may not agree on everything, that if we can start there, now I've got a way to work on them.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's really important to have your voice as an anti-war voice out there, because, you know, social psychology is such an important thing. And we saw this with Ron Paul probably better than anyone else on my issue on war, where there's just this idea that you have to either be a completely ignorant, jobless, patchouli stinking hippie, or a big fat commie hypocrite millionaire like Michael Moore to be anti-war. or some, you know, Hollywood actress or something. Who's anti-war except a bunch of contemptible people that you know, the country music side of American culture just cannot identify with? Well, yeah. Ron Paul comes out and says, oh, no, you could be, you know, a white Protestant conservative Republican from Texas and be anti-war as hell. Look at me. And everybody went, wow, okay, great. So I don't have to change anything else about what I believe about myself in order to change my opinion about this important thing, which I kind of have been dying to change for a while now, you know. And so he was sort of writing them a doctor's prescription or a permission slip that it's okay for you to be anti-war now. You can be an anti-war Republican like me. So I think, you know, on these issues, us libertarians, we got to always outflank the right on the right and the left on the left on the things that they're good on, and then take them back to, like you said, that consistency, that all we're saying is don't hurt people and take their stuff on this issue or this issue, mm-hmm. you know?
No, and I think you hit the nail on the head. I think one of the biggest problems in America is that if you are in your, as you say, anti-war, you're labeled as someone who is siding with the enemy, someone who doesn't believe in supporting our troops, who doesn't believe in the flag and America, and who's weak and cowardly. And none of those things are true. What you're simply saying is, hey, I believe in violence only to defend myself and those I love from the imminent threat of violence. And I don't support going around the world and defending every single person who has something bad or empire building or whatever else. And that doesn't mean that I don't love freedom and that I don't love my country. It just means that I'm unwilling to sacrifice somebody else's life for the sake of a third party.
There you go. Simple as that. All right. Listen, I accidentally kept you over time a little bit here, but thanks very much for coming on the show, Jason. Good to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it, Scott. Bye.
All right. So that is Jason Stapleton. Check him out at jasonstapleton.com. And hey, you know, I don't know, possibly on the radio in your town. We'll be right back. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. Man, I got a lot of articles I got to read this afternoon. Jeez, give me a break here. anyway, I should not complain. I'm not in a war, man. I'm just complaining about wars. That's not anything too bad for me. Tonight, Hornberger Show, liberty.me. The future freedom every Thursday night, guys. So remember that from now on. No TV for you. Thursday nights, it's liberty.me. I interviewed Jacob Hornberger about things. The future of freedom is the name of our show. You'll like it. It's basically just like this, only with my video camera thing on. And for just a half an hour. And it's always Hornberger as my guest. He's very libertarian. It's a good time. I think you'll like it. That's 8 o'clock Eastern Time, 7 o'clock tonight. For those of you dying to be terribly disappointed to see what my voice looks like after some period of time. Oh, you're Scott Horton? Huh. That's what they tell me. Anyway, tonight, the Hornberger Show. You might or might not like it. Okay, now, I gotta talk about the gun thing for just a second here. Mostly just as a study in media nonsense. Oh, we did a poll, says National Public Radio. We did a poll, and people support background checks. Oh, they do, huh? Well, that's funny, because they passed the Brady Bill 25 years ago or something, right? 20 years ago. I think 25 years ago, maybe. They got background checks. What are you talking about? Oh, what a fun little shorthand, as George Bush would call a lie. For we want to make every private gun transfer public. We want to make it a crime for you to leave a gun to your son, to give one to your pal, without going and registering it with the state first. Selling it at a garage sale or whatever informal method. Private to private dealers. They call it the gun show loophole. As though there are these madman black market arms dealers who are showing up at gun shows and just passing out M60s for, you know, widespread and constant use in mass murder sprees. And we must close this gun show loophole. But what is it that they're preventing? Nobody's ever, I guess maybe there was at Columbine, they went to a gun show, but they bought them legit. And they bought one from a private dealer and one from a public one or whatever, and it was fine. They had their friend do it. She had a background check, something like that, right? The whole thing is a red herring. And, you know, disturbingly, you know, not this part. I'll get to the disturbing part. Rick from the bumper sticker would go and sell, you know, pro-gun bumper stickers at the gun show. And I made a little sign that said the gun show loophole. Like that was the name of his little business where he was selling bumper stickers. The gun show loophole. And nobody at the gun show even knew what that meant at all. And I was thinking, man, you guys need to get educated on what those who would take your guns away are trying to do to you. You know, you're not paying attention at all here. You'd think if anybody was pro-gun, it would be a bunch of people at a gun show buying guns. The gun show loophole, as though somebody's getting away with something. But the point being how they reduce all that to background checks. Yeah, there's no background checks. The American people, by 51%, it says in the poll, they support background checks. Yeah, so we already have background checks. They're trying to imply that we don't? You know, finally get around to passing America's first gun law, huh? And then here's the other thing that they never, ever mention, which is the Second Amendment is the law of the land. And so even if the democracy doesn't like it, they don't have the authority to take people's guns away. They don't have the authority to hire the government to take people's guns away. I mean, they certainly don't have the right, but they don't have the legal authority under our political system either. Takes 2/3 of both houses of Congress and 3/4 of the state legislatures to amend the Constitution. Unless you want to try to call a constitutional convention, which I guess you'd need, what, just 2/3 of the state legislatures calling for just that. Interesting debate about that on the Tom Woods Show recently, by the way, if you're interested. But anyway, you notice how that is never in the discussion when the liberals talk about gun control. Especially, man, I like listening to NPR radio news where the whole thing is spoken from, like, you know, they know that they're talking to Rachel Maddow's audience out there uniformly, basically. So we all already agree about just what barbarians all these right-wing hillbilly gun owners are, right, everybody? Is sort of the agreed-upon premise of their every bit of coverage of this issue. And yet they have to lie and obfuscate and shorthand the actual facts right out of their discussion in order to try to make people seem unreasonable. And they just never mention the right of a person to brandish and or use a firearm to deter and or end a credible threat to their life or some other innocent person's life. And then you see, don't you see all these red herrings about how, well, there were armed people at the campus there in Oregon, but they didn't intervene, they ran. Well, nobody said everybody with a gun is supposed to be a vigilante and intervene. so they have the right to defend themselves. No one in the classroom who were the victims, none of them had guns. But when did anyone ever say that the Second Amendment meant, or, you know, the right of people to carry a firearm, concealed or otherwise, on their person, meant that they now are all automatically deputized and must go and risk their life to intervene in any situation? That's not the argument. The argument is, if someone had tried to pull that on them in the classroom that they were in, they would have had a fighting chance instead of none. That's the argument. And who could argue with that? You know, they got to keep it. It's kind of like the right wing on every other issue. They have to keep the whole argument in the level of unreality, so that they seem right, because they're not even connecting with the truth at all. They're just above it and past it. And all their false assumptions assumed and just baked in to all of their arguments. And yet, this shooter here, he got his guns legally. In the vast majority of these, you read any journalists or social scientists who've actually done the work and the research, mentally ill people are even less likely to hurt you than, or maybe they're just slightly more likely to hurt you than someone who's not mentally ill. They're much more likely to be a victim of violent abuse than perpetrate it. Somebody could be absolutely nuts and not dangerous at all. Someone could be perfectly sane and do something terrible. And just because in your imagination there's a real strong correlation there doesn't really mean it's true. I mean, you look at the people who are doing these mass shootings of strangers. I mean, excluding people who are fighting over drug turf or, you know, kill innocents in the middle of a robbery or whatever. But where people are just massacring strangers because of how angry they are, they're mostly dejected, you know, loner losers. And so what are you going to do then? You're going to have a Chinese personality score on everybody? Yeah. How much they're getting laid and how much beer they're drinking with their buddies and make sure they're not unhappy. Or if they are unhappy, that they're not allowed to own a gun now. And who are you putting in charge of that again? The feds?
Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, so this freak show McCarthy dropped out of the House race, which is funny. I didn't know anything about him except what a ridiculous boob he is. Phil Giraldi has a really funny piece that was the spotlight on antiwar.com yesterday. American Exceptionalism Awards or something. Where he goes on quoting all of this guy's malapropisms. He's way worse than me. Worse than George W. Bush or Dan Quayle by a factor of a few, I think. And now he's dropped out, and a Twitter friend sent me this story where Walter Jones, formerly Freedom Fries Jones, now almost Ron Paulian Walter Jones, he came out, yesterday, and warned the leadership candidates to drop out of the race right now if they have issues of moral turpitude in their lives, in their personal lives. And so it was a letter apparently addressed everyone who's sort of kind of half announced or more in the running to be the new House Speaker. He said, hey, listen, if you've done something nasty off the clock, while a congressman, go ahead and bow out now. So that may or may not have anything to do with this idiot calling it in. It could be, too, that he's such an incompetent fool when it comes to speaking out loud that, you know, maybe somebody with money said, find somebody else, or I don't know what. Anyway, that's pretty funny. It mostly doesn't matter who's the Speaker of the House, but oh, you know, actually, sometimes it matters a lot. So I guess we'll see. Wouldn't that be funny if somehow they just all threw up their hands and said, fine, and made Walter Jones the House Speaker? Yeah, well, not likely. Okay. Yeah, hey, more NPR criticism. Why? Because I've had a lot of errands to run. So I was listening to NPR News, and they can hardly say a damn sentence without making me think of something to complain about on my own radio show tomorrow when it comes. In this case, I already mentioned on the show, but I gotta go back over this. I already mentioned on the show every day for the last 4.5 years, but I gotta mention it again. Spinning Al-Qaeda on NPR News. The outrage, if you're up to date on all of your talking points and how you're supposed to feel about foreign policy issues, the talking point is that Putin is not only bombing Islamic State targets, he is also bombing rebel targets. And that is to you an outrage. Aren't you outraged? Makes it sound like ISIS actually is on Assad's side. They're a pro-government militia that we're all trying to stop, right? But instead, they're fighting against, the Russians are bombing the rebels. Except that, no, the Islamic State are the most powerful faction fighting against Assad. They are the rebels. And second place is the al-Nusra Front. The difference between the two, the Islamic State, which still is loyal to bin Laden's memory and claims his legacy, they want a caliphate now, and they've declared one. Whereas Al-Qaeda is still loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two in Al-Qaeda, who says, no, keep fighting. You've got to get rid of the Americans first, and only then can you have your caliphate, because they'll come and bomb it, kind of thing. Has been his idea. And mostly, it's just a faction fight over who you take orders from, Golani or Baghdadi. And yet, so there's this figure of speech, ISIS, too brutal even for Al-Qaeda. Well, that's not really true. I mean, it's true that they've massacred more people than al-Nusra has, but that's a tactical difference or a strategic difference in how they do battle. It's not a moral qualm. You see how quickly you can go from the Islamic State, they butcher even more innocent people than Al-Qaeda, to, geez, Al-Qaeda, they hardly butcher innocent people at all. Why, they're downright moderate. All it takes is just a couple of figures of speech, and that's how bad they get you. And you're supposed to just not know or forget or Google too hard to find out that, well, wait, al-Nusra is Al-Qaeda in Syria. Still loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher in New York City. Speaking of killing civilians, anybody remember that thing we're all supposed to never forget? But on NPR, I swear to you, man, I should have went back and found the story so I could play the clip for you. But anyway, if you watch TV news or if you listen to radio news at all, you're hearing this over and over again. No mention of al-Nusra at all. No mention of the names of any of these moderate groups either. Ahrar al-Sham? Well, they behead people. They do suicide attacks. They fight side by side with al-Qaeda on a daily basis. How moderate is that? Not very damned moderate. Al-Farouk Brigade? Yeah, sometimes they eat the livers or hearts, it's debated, of dead soldiers. But other than that, they're pretty moderate. The Northern Storm Brigade, they sold Stephen Sotloff, the American journalist, to ISIS, who then later cut his head off. But other than that, they're great guys. Oh, they're on camera telling Time Magazine, yeah, we're all veterans of Iraq War II, where we fought with Zarqawi against the Americans. Yeah, they're very moderate, those guys. Zarqawi stormtroopers of death, whose speciality was, you know, butchering Shiite women and children in the marketplace back in Iraq War II. Yes, these factions are all very moderate. Sometimes they cut people's heads off and crucify them and suicide bomb them to death. And yeah, they all still love Osama bin Laden and praise the September 11th attacks. Patrick Coburn asks them, so what do you guys think about September 11th? They go, oh, yeah, kill them all. They're very moderate, these guys. They're very moderate. And then on NPR, they go, oh, the American Pentagon and State Department are outraged that the Russians aren't just attacking ISIS. They're attacking the other rebel groups. Well, but Putin never said he was going to only attack ISIS. He said he was only going to attack terrorists. Is NPR saying that Al-Qaeda are not terrorists? Have we really gone all the way from ISIS makes it a special point to murder civilians on a grander scale than Al-Qaeda in Syria these days, to Al-Qaeda, why, they're not terrorists at all. They're our friends. They're the moderates. Just because someone works for the CIA doesn't make them a moderate. Get it? Or maybe just because someone works for the CIA, that's what makes them a moderate. Get it? And you gotta admit that in a way, and I'm not talking about all the civilians that the Russians are surely killing, and I don't know the numbers, but they, you know, air war is air war. I'm not in favor of it at all. But I do appreciate the fact that, in a sense, that the first thing they do is bomb the CIA's guys. They're not less terrorist than the Islamic State. And just the fact that it's a finger in the eye of the Americans, the Israelis, the Turks, the Saudis, the Qataris, who've been behind this treason for all these years. It is, it's treason. And you know what? All you got to do is a simple thought experiment for a moment. You see where my misplaced TH sound came from there. simple kind of thought experiment. If Obama is backing al-Nusra and their friends and arming them and financing them and working with all of our allies to do that, how come the Republicans aren't accusing him of that? Your answers are either one, I'm a crazy kook conspiracy nut liar type, or all the Republicans are even worse on it than him. All the Republicans are even more in the pocket of the foreign government that is the Israeli state. And the Saudis too, I guess, you know, bankrolling whoever's left over. They are even worse. It's not Obama, it's John McCain over there posing with the Northern Storm Brigade. So, I don't know. I just think it's kind of funny because the truth is so far from anything that they can accurately describe to you. They just have to, you know, completely BS. Here Hillary Clinton is still saying the top priority is getting rid of Assad, right? Like if this was the British talking about how to help the North destroy the American Confederacy, step one, kill Abraham Lincoln.